This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today we air the forum, What Does the Inland Port Mean for Utah? The Inland Port refers to the planned development of Salt Lake City's northwestern quadrant into a logistics and distribution hub connecting coastal seaports to inland destinations through rail and ground transportation, with Salt Lake City lying at a major intersection of these routes. The Inland Port plan has been a point of contention between the state and city governments, as well as environmental and business interests. Earlier this year, Salt Lake City Mayor Jackie Biskupski filed a lawsuit against the state over the port on the basis of usurpation of the city's taxing and land use powers. In addition, the monthly meetings of the Inland Port Authority Board in April and May have been held up by protesters citing concerns of the port's impact on the local environment and air quality. The forum was recorded on April 4, 2019, and was moderated by Maura Carabello, founder of the Exoro Group, an advisor and strategist to Utah political and business leaders. Joining her on the panel are District 1 Councilman and member of the Inland Port Authority, James Rogers, Utah Speaker Greg Hughes, and Miles Hansen, President and CEO of the World Trade Center Utah.
We're going to start by letting them maybe take just a couple of minutes and from their perspective introduce the segments of their participation that I didn't get to, and start off about their perspective on the Inland Port. So this will just be a couple of minute intro to their point of view for the Inland Port. Miles, I think I'll start here.
Absolutely. It's fantastic to be here. So less than 24 hours ago, I was on a flight back from Saudi Arabia here, which means it's about midnight Saudi time. So if I start falling asleep in this, Greg, just give me an elbow to keep me awake. But it's great to be here, and it's great to be back in Utah. Like Mara said, I came back here in August after a career living in a lot of different countries. And when it comes to the Inland Port, these two here are the experts, and I'm the rookie that is trying to understand it. But as the rookie, I thought it would be helpful to give a bit of an overview for why we're talking about Inland Port, why this project is so important for the state of Utah. And I'll do that with a bit of a story. So in early October, we led a World Trade Center Utah, working with the legislature, then Speaker Hughes, led a trade mission to China. And we were taking Utah companies with us, many of which have been under pressure because of the trade dispute. So we took a look at the program. We said, let's get a meeting with the leadership of Shanghai Port. It's the main port where a lot of goods enter from the U.S. into China, including these Utah companies that were really struggling. As they get yanked around by mid-level people at the port, we thought, you know what, if we could get with the chairman, with his senior team, this is going to help these companies the next time they have issues, they can reach out to senior people at the port and get some help. So we had a dinner with the chairman of Shanghai International Port Group. It's the largest port operation in the entire world. They have a fully automated port, so they're very, very advanced. Really exciting stuff. It was fantastic to be with him and his team and to help these Utah companies make the connection. And of course, at the dinner, I was on one side and Speaker Hughes was on the other side. And so, of course, we talked about the Inland Port. And it was interesting because the chairman at the beginning of the dinner, he didn't seem all that interested in Utah or the group. I'd guarantee you that he couldn't find Utah on a map. Somebody told him, hey, you got this group from Utah, you got to have dinner with them. And he said, okay. So we sat down for dinner. The first course was lobster covered in mayonnaise, which was a combination I had never experienced.
By the way.
It's as bad as it sounds. And so we're sitting there. You could tell he's tired and worn out. We're eating lobster and mayonnaise. And to be honest, I was like, man, I hope this works out. But he has been involved with ports and operations for 40 years. He doesn't care about Utah, but he knows a lot about ports and logistics and getting goods from point A to point B. So as part of dinner, we start talking about why Utah is doing an inland port. And so if you think about a map of the United States, where do the freeways north, south, east, west intersect? That's right, Salt Lake City. Where do the rail lines north, south, east, west intersect? Salt Lake City. Where's even the fiber optic line, Salt Lake City, the only new airport that's being constructed in the country, Salt Lake City. And so as we walked through this with him, you could see somebody who could care less about Utah but knows ports and logistics, his excitement started to increase. He got more and more enthusiastic about it. We showed him the freeways, the rail links, everything's happening here, the thousands of acres of undeveloped land that's right next to the capital city of the state with the best economy in the country. And by the end of it, he was super excited. He wanted to send a team out. And we told him, hey, you know, we welcome you coming. We got a little work to do here on this end to develop the business model. But then we absolutely will have a team come out to look at partnership opportunities. And so you have the chairman of the largest port operation in the world, very interested in the inland port, not because he cares about Utah, but because of the merits of the project and the very unique situation we have here in Utah. And so for me, somebody who didn't really know much about the inland port, at that point I'd been in the job about 6 weeks, that was a confirming moment that this project is important, we need to get it right, and that the reason why we're doing it is because we have all of the elements to put together something that's going to be very critical to helping Utah continue to develop our economy. I look forward to talking more about it.
Thanks. So when I became Speaker of the House, one of the responsibilities is that the state of Utah has a relationship with China, with one of its provinces, Liaoning province. And so we do these, and it's been going on for over a decade, where provincial leaders would travel to Utah, we would entertain and host them here, show them the things that are going on in Utah by way of economy. We have a very robust dual immersion Mandarin Chinese program in our public schools, not just per capita, but more of these schools on the ground than any other state in the country. And so there's a lot of unique partnerships that are already going on or were going on before I became speaker. And as I took on this mantle of responsibility and had to carry through and host their delegation as they came to Utah and then travel to Liaoning and learn more about their economy and what they were doing, China is, as you probably well know, is just booming. It's changing very fast, the fastest growing middle class in the world. Its economy is predicted to overtake in terms of size and strength our United States economy in the next year or so. India is not far behind. And I probably, before I made that trip, didn't appreciate the magnitude of what's going on, certainly around the world, but particularly in China. And the global supply chain, how we decide as consumers to buy, purchase things, the trade that goes on between our countries, as you see the trade disputes going on right now between their central government and our federal government. We were coming away from these experiences, these province to state relationships, with strong friendships, partnerships, and at the same time realizing that there was so much potential for a state like Utah, where we do have a very diverse economy. We don't just, if you're North Dakota, it's all about natural resources, and if that changes, your whole state changes. Utah has one of the most diverse economies in the country, and where we have manufacturing or agriculture, or we have natural resources, or we have tech, we have so many areas where we could see, certainly as the world is flat and the global supply chain becomes stronger, so many strong opportunities where we could lead by example. And so as we looked at this, you have Kansas City, Louisville, they have inland ports east of the Mississippi. We don't have a single one west of the Mississippi in the western states. And as Miles pointed out, logistically, if you look at what it would take to be a smart inland port, what would you need? Well, you need rail. When you find out that every rail line that leaves the western seaboard coastal ports, they all winnow into the state of Utah, that's an obvious advantage. When you see I-15 that starts in Alaska, goes through all of Canada, through the western United States, and down through Mexico, three countries, that's a pretty good advantage as well. Then you have I-80 and I-70 that goes across. And again, as Miles mentioned, the only full rebuild of an airport, international airport in the country, is going on in this state. A lot of exciting things are happening. Well, we looked at that, and we this inland port concept, I saw a study from the 80s when the global supply chain wasn't even as strong, where this was such a big deal. So last year, we thought it was pretty important to put a stake in the ground and begin this process of an inland port, create a board, create the structure by which we would start to organize and have this inland port concept, logistics, everything else. It's not a small task. It's a good thing we did. I think the free flow of information has been so powerful because when you start an inland port, a jurisdiction, and you have a board, which we have a board member here that's on that board, there's almost an urgency to coming up with smart ideas and smart solutions. And we're seeing things that are being brought to the table that will even address some of the concerns that have been brought up in some of the inland port board meetings now through a satellite bonded U.S. Customs port, but satellites around the state So maybe the natural resources do not have to go through the customs process in Salt Lake City. All those solutions, the rising tide lifting all ships and looking at how we do this as a state, those solutions are coming forward, but they wouldn't have if we had not begun. If we kept circling like they had in the 80s with that report, I don't know that we'd be any further along. And you have at the same time states like New Mexico watching what Utah has done that's begun to fast track an inland port concept. Interesting to note too, and then I'll turn the time over to Roger. See, I'm a recovering lawmaker. You put a nickel in me and I just give you a buck's worth of speech, so I'm sorry. The interesting thing that was new, which was encouraging for me, was I thought that Long Beach and Oakland and Portland and Seattle, that they would not like an inland port. They'd see it maybe as competition. What we learned is that you have ships, container ships, idling out in that ocean for a month at a time or more, waiting to get in, waiting to get through that process, waiting to get through into the United States. And you have that same kind of bottleneck going out. It was great news for me to hear that all of these ports, if there was a way to have a bonded U.S. Customs inland port concept or model here in the state of Utah, they could begin to move those containers in and out in a much more efficient way. And they see Utah as a partner in that effort, not as competition. So once you know that it's not crabs in a bucket trying to pull each other down, but you have this generational opportunity to do something very unique, and I think that is the future of our economy, is this global supply chain. I think we have it. We owe it to you, the people of Utah. We owe it to our country in terms of robust trade back and forth to get it right. And I think that that's what's happening right now with the conversations we're having.
So 5 years ago when I ran for office, I did not expect to be involved with an inland port, with a prison relocation, with homeless resource centers, within all of Salt Lake City. And these are things that are, you know, impacting Salt Lake City. Inside Salt Lake City, if you were to look at where we've come from a year ago to where we are with the Inland Port Board and how we're moving forward, there would be a lot of people that would be upset with saying we're not being transparent or we're not being open or we're not doing the things that would make good policy. But if you actually take a look at where we've come from the start to where we are today, we're more transparent than any other board that exists in the state of Utah. We hold two public hearings before we even vote on an issue. We give opportunity for comments in the public forum two times before the vote comes to us. So, you know, Mr. Hansen talked about how unique it is for Salt Lake City to have this opportunity for the inland port, which it is, but there are also some detriments that can come with this. And if you look at what we're talking about, you have I-215, I-80, I-15, you've got rail, you've got the refineries, you've got Staker Parson mining on Beck Street. So with the state, they've got these air quality monitors, and there's about five of them around the state. And the one that continually fails time and time again is in Rose Park, my home. And so as we're moving forward, the state understands that. We're looking at ways that we can have the least amount of negative impact, which is key for me and my residents. But if you also look at what the area is lacking in District 1, it's good paying jobs. You know, we have the highest minority population in the state of Utah. All of our schools on the west side are Title I schools, meaning that we have free and subsidized lunch. So for me, when I was elected, my main point was to create opportunities to good jobs, opportunity to education, opportunity for individuals to lift themselves up. And for me, this is an opportunity for us to create that in the inland port. And when you look at the inland port, most people are going to think, if you look at what businesses have been brought inside of this area from Salt Lake City, it's Amazon, it's UPS, it's Post Cereal. And are those the types of jobs that create opportunities for the residents in District 1? I would say no. $13 an hour is not a way for somebody to create a living for themselves. They're going to be working two or three jobs in order to do that. So as we look at what Salt Lake City has done compared to the vision that we are looking as an inland port board, we want to create manufacturing jobs, jobs that have, you know, retirement, pensions, and opportunities for health care, so that they can afford to stay home on the weekend and not work that second job. So for me, it's a different point of view than the state is looking at. It's looking at what can we create for the individuals in District 1. And outside of District 1 in Salt Lake City, it's creating those access to opportunities for education, creating opportunities for transportation and healthcare. It's creating the livelihood that most of us are currently have, but it's continuing that and creating the greater opportunity. I just want to highlight one thing before we go back to questions, is that if you look at the home values in all of Salt Lake City, you look at the percentage of growth, the increase that has the greatest increase, it's inside of District 1. Why? Because you're close to freeways, you're close to downtown, you're not driving 45 minutes to go to school or to your employment. So these are things that are great things for District 1, but we can create an even greater opportunity for access and success.
Terrific. I'm going to give a little primer again, and then we're going to move into a question about authority, because this topic has both sort of fact-driven, a lot of data-driven things, and it has a great deal of politics. So again, an inland port, as we've often seen defined, is just a logistics and a distribution hub that's held inland. It has a robust relationship with sealand ports, and in fact, that's a lot of the discussion. And as you've heard from everyone, it seems to be mutually agreed in the public that from the perspective of railroad transportation, the hubs, the logistics portion, Utah is very unique in this. And as you've heard said, it is being said over and over, it's the most significant economic opportunity. I think some discussions that people really want to have around that, if there's some degree of consensus around that, I think what we're biting off now is the environmental concerns that we have, air quality concerns that go with that, traffic and congestion, and the government transparency issues. And as we, so I'm sort of giving a tick list again of the things we need to discuss. And I think the environmental concerns and the hazardous waste concerns probably fall into two categories. One is the physical environment around us, those living in proximity, our air quality problems, as well as then some environmental concerns about what's actually being transported. So those are slightly different concerns. When the Gardner Center did a study of characteristics for the inland port 2 years ago, the areas that they looked at were population. It needs to have a population of 3 million, and they said that Salt Lake County, in this instance, had that. Class of railroad, we've already talked about. Foreign trade zones, Mr. Hansen to talk about, but that's a key dimension. Labor, as Councilman Rogers has pointed out. Commodity scope, so that's the natural resources, the agricultural, the chemical products. Infrastructure. We got to require development on that. So that's where the inland port is. And governing body and governing partnerships in this instance, again, in 2016, before the legislature took action last cycle, it had an open to discussion. So I'm going to segue that with what happened with the legislature. I want to ask the question, who's in charge? And because I think from the outside looking in, who's in charge? But not just from a port authority, who's in charge, but who are the other stakeholders that maybe need an informal seat at the table? So I'm going to start at the far end with our representative from Salt Lake City.
Well, we've currently hired an interim director, somebody from who used to work for GOED, which is Chris Conaby. He is the interim director. We've gone out with an RFP to hire the full-time executive director. And that's in the process of doing interviews currently. So currently, the executive director is Chris Conaby. The chair is Derek Miller, the former World Trade Director, now who's over the Salt Lake Chamber. I'm the current vice chair, so I'd say that the board is what's leading out.
And this is the Inland Port Authority Board that was the jurisdiction was made by the legislature last year, and it has, I'm sure you all know, has designated seats, some of which
11
come from
board
local
members,
jurisdictions,
right.
And some come from the state. Okay. So who are the other stakeholders that need a seat at the table, Speaker Hughes?
So I don't think that it's a city's job. If all the roles that you take on as a city council member, international trade cannot be the first or foremost duty of a city. It's like the homeless issue. While all those resources and centers to help people were found in Salt Lake City, everyone didn't grow up blocks away from that area. It was not a city issue. It was clearly a state issue. As we've described this inland port, this is not a Salt Lake City issue, not in a disparaging way, but we're not foisting the entire Western United States global supply chain on one city jurisdiction. It wouldn't be fair. So the stakeholders would be the state of Utah. You have a lot of political subdivisions, counties, economic development directors of the different economies that you see across this state aware of and excited about the inland port and the opportunities that they bring, they would argue they are stakeholders as well. And so I would say that And it gets broader, even to the outside of our state. I think you're going to find a lot of interested parties and stakeholders. Let's take our two rail lines. Here's a debate. We're a Union Pacific town. Right now, Union Pacific has primarily the greatest access or only access to Salt Lake or this area. But we know that the most successful inland ports are on main lines where UBSF and Union Pacific both have access to those areas. And so there'll need to be infrastructure, rail spurs, to make sure that those rail lines, the two major ones, have access to an inland port, that it's not just monopolized for one. But that takes infrastructure. But I would argue that both of those major rail lines see themselves as stakeholders in making sure that this is successful. I just want to throw this out here, and we'll probably explore it later, but there is a satellite concept model. So that when we look at the Salt Lake and we talk about this airshed and we talk about the clean air, there is very good conversation going on, and counties and areas that say, look, if I'm in the Uinta Basin and we have natural resources, why bring it all the way to Salt Lake to then potentially go to the Gulf of Mexico or to the, to California? Is there a way to make this satellite concept viable? And the answer to that is yes. And when you do that, I think that begins to mitigate some of the concerns, natural concerns, reasonable concerns we'd have about everything culminating to the area just west of the airport. Now, again, you have to say that carefully, because you don't want people to get territorial and go, well, wait a minute, we had all this opportunity and you're going to spread it out and take it somewhere else. I truly believe that the rising tide will lift all ships, that this state, if we do it right, the manufacturing jobs and opportunities that will arrive in this state, the opportunities that we'll have to be able to reach those areas, those end users that are looking for the types of jobs, industries, things that we have in the state of Utah, and the things they want to bring back. No one's going to lose if you do it right. And I think that satellite concept is incredibly important, if for one reason, for the environmental impact.
So what am I? Oh, go ahead. Sorry,
quick add on the satellite concept. So right now, there's a free trade zone that already exists. And so it's distinct and different from the inland port. The free trade zone was set up decades ago. It was recently greatly expanded. And what that means is within the free trade zone area within Salt Lake City, but also anywhere within 60 miles of Salt Lake City, a company can apply to be part of this free trade zone. What that means is they can bring goods into the country without paying tariffs or customs duties, as long as it stays within this free trade zone area. They then could do some manufacturing and re-export it without ever paying tariffs or customs duties, which right now, in an era of increasing tariffs, is very important for businesses. They can also bring it in, and they don't have to pay customs or tariffs until it leaves the free trade zone and enters the U.S. market, which can help significantly reduce the cost of maintaining inventories for companies that take advantage of that. So again, it's technically centered just out by the airport, but the existing regulation allows for 60 miles. So you think about the hub and spoke model, right? You could be a manufacturer in Box Elder County, or it could be down south in Payson, until you get to the 60-mile radius, and you could import what you need. You can manufacture goods and re-export that through the inland port, but using a rail link, the rail lines that exist north to south, and greatly benefit from the inland port facility, and you can still participate in the free trade zone. And so you can see how that then would allow us to take semi-trucks off the roads. It would allow us to create jobs pushing out off the Wasatch Front. And so this really is an opportunity that is available for companies and people and communities and ultimately the individuals that reside therein, far beyond just the immediate area around the inland port, District 1, or even along the Wasatch Front. But we have to have a very, very broad statewide perspective. We have to understand the challenging issues that we're talking about, because we have to get it right, because the consequences are statewide. It's not limited to one specific location.
So when you hear the conversation, just to close this, of location, and I'm hearing more and more discussions about Tooele and Tooele County, what I'm hearing is the hub and spoke. I'm not hearing an alternative to the Northwest Quadrant in Salt Lake City. I'm hearing a relationship between. Is that
so? You're the you're the Inland Port Board, it's your vision, and you will hopefully, what I hope to see happen, and I think that you have a lot of political subdivisions that would love the hub and spoke model. They want to be part, and they want to be a satellite and be part of this. If you talk about Tooele, there is some incredible advantages to the infrastructure that's in Tooele. One of the great ones is if you look at going behind the Oakers to I-15 going south, instead of coming around that pinch between the Oakers and Great Salt Lake, 70%, by the way, of that traffic are people that live in Tooele County who are employed in Salt Lake County. So imagine if that Tooele County, the satellite, had jobs, had place opportunities for people to work there, you could really cut down on the congestion and the traffic that you're seeing as people from Tooele County are looking for employment or going to their employment in Salt Lake County. But if you go to the road, there's, I think, Amazon or it might be Walmart. They are using the road behind the Oakers that links up with I-15. It's 30 minutes quicker, and it avoids all of that Wasatch Front traffic, which would be an incredible advantage. And again, not to supplant or to take the place of, but to, again, much like when Long Beach said, we need to move. We got to keep going. There's so much demand. The economy's growing. China's middle class. They have more workers that make the equivalent of $100,000 a year than we have total employees in the country, in this country. That is shocking, for me at least, when I learned that those statistics. So the buying power, the economics that are going on in China, if you can get things moving quicker but do it in an efficient way, everybody is going to be more successful. I got a kid in college right now, in college age. She is Sophie. I genuinely worry that in 2 years she would not be able to afford to live in Utah. With the cost of housing, the opportunities, prepared workforce, I worry, and she's my oldest. I want my daughter to live close by. I don't want her to have to move. And so it even gets personal with me in terms of how do you, and because we're growing from within, we have people that come to this state, but we're growing. You can say I'm anti-growth. Guess what? We're still growing as a state. So what's going to happen? Where are the jobs going to come from? How are we going to, what's our future look like if we don't provide these kinds of opportunities? And so I think it's, I'm very bullish, as you well know, on this, but I do think that it comports. I think it's a way to make sure that you grow the pie. There's a lot of talk you'll see up there. I love it that I'm not up there, about tax reform, taxing more things that right now we don't currently tax. That's going to be a hard political lift, I'm going to tell you. It's going to be very difficult to start taxing some of the real estate and attorneys and everything else. I would argue, let's grow this pie. Let's see that there's good paying jobs. People can raise families here. You're seeing the economy grow, but doing it in a responsible way.
So Councilman Rogers, as you answer that, one of the dimensions, some context I'd like you to put in it is the timeline. So with that, I'm gonna ask who else is vying for this? What is our competition? And sort of what I'm getting to there is, what is our timeline? How quickly should we feel like you're rushing it too much? What's going to be the pacing of decision-making with the Port Authority?
You know, that's a great question, because I think no matter what, there are going to be people who are skeptics and say that we're rushing it. But as we have the right policy discussions and put them in place, I don't think that there's any dispute that people can say that we're rushing it. I think that you're always going to have the skeptics saying that. But, you know, if you look at the job force, if somebody read the Wall Street Journal about 2 weeks ago, there was an article talking about the state of Utah and our job force, that we are one of few states that actually are creating a job force, whereas most states are diminishing their job force. So, yeah, it's a great question. You know, former speakers spoke about New Mexico and how they're trying to streamline that process. But it's unique in the fact that Utah is really one of the top-run states in the nation. And we are so diverse in minerals and other assets in the state that this hub-and-spoke model will create jobs not only for Salt Lake City residents or, you know, outside the county there, but in other areas and other counties. So, you know, there's going to be skepticism as you're moving forward, but for me, to make sure we're transparent, it is all about policy. It's all about the policy discussion. You know, when the we had the special session in order to move the Inland Port forward, we set aside 10% for affordable housing. In Salt Lake City, if you're spending more than 30% of your income, you're going to live in poverty if you're spending more than 30% on your housing. And that's a fact that most people in Salt Lake City that are living in minimum wage jobs, they're spending 50, 60, 70% of their income on housing. So it's creating this dialogue of what can the Inland Port do for the state of Utah besides what it's going to do. So I think moving forward, that's the key for us.
So feel free to say you can't answer this before you have an executive director, but what would be the scope of work in 2019 for the Port Authority?
A business plan. And that's something that's already gone out to RFP. We're looking at a business plan on how to move this forward. That's the number one. The other one is tax increment financing, discussing that, understanding what those taxes are going to be used for, infrastructure, what else it can do to promote the Inland Port. So those are two unique questions that we need to answer, and it's going to be a deep policy question that we're going to dive into, what we've already started to discuss.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. On this program, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them, unedited, mostly in their entirety, as a public service. Today we are airing a panel discussion held on February 4th, 2019. Here's moderator Maura Carabello of the XRO Group.
So I want to move to the environment. So a couple of standards I'm going to give all of us is that year after year now, education and air quality fight for the number one spot in what voters care most about. And recently, air quality hits the top of it. So one, I'm just going to say, I think we all believe that air quality matters. And so we don't need to retestify to that. I want to talk about what are we looking at? Are we looking at models? Are we looking at mitigation? And again, I think air quality falls into two categories. One is the increased transportation traffic. One is just the environmental, and I'm going to say air quality and water impacts of having light industry in your area. So maybe I'll broaden it to the environment, but we all want to hear about air quality as well. I want to know, sir, so what are the approaches? What are we looking at in terms of mitigation?
I'll jump into that. You know, it comes back to the policy questions, right? We know that industries, they know what is the cutting edge in their technology. You know, whether it's electric switch rails for the rail yard. But there's so many impacts. Senator Luz Escamilla is going to run a bill on baseline monitoring. We don't know what the baseline is currently out there. So if we have a baseline monitoring, we can see where that impact is. And it all comes back to, again, is policy. I don't know if Salt Lake City would have been the right city to try and lead this forward, because I don't want to see Amazons out there. I don't want to see Post cereals or UPS where we have three shifts of 250 cars each shift going in there, where we're having thousands of cars impacting there, when we can look at transparency and through tax increment finance for creating jobs with manufacturing, where you're having fewer jobs, but you're creating it through rail where they're shipping it out. Because we know that rail is so much better for the environment when you're shipping than you're having 1,000 trucks out on the road.
So, Speaker, now that you can armchair quarterback, is a Republican legislature going to pass Senator Escamilla's bill to monitor, and are they going to put money behind environmental mitigation in the Inland Port?
Yeah, so I'll give you a little peek behind the curtain on how they prioritize clean air bills. We have a clean air caucus. It's bipartisan. They meet every single week. During the session, once a month when they're not in session, talking about solutions for clean air. There are some inherent challenges to a valley that we have that's growing in population. Tailpipes are part of that. Tier 3 fuel, incentivizing the refineries. There's so much that by way of refineries that are required to have Tier 3 fuel. The automobiles that are being made today handle the Tier 3 fuel. But it doesn't have to be all of the fuel that a company that would make gasoline would have to provide. What Utah did is we provided incentives to make sure that the upgrades for the refineries would happen here, so we could ensure that the Tier 3 fuel would be made here or refined here. And that has a huge 80%. It'll be 80% cleaner in terms of tailpipes with Tier 3 fuel with Tier 3 automobiles. Those are some of the things we have done. But this is how the calculus works. We're not the federal government, so you're not printing money. You're looking at the ideas that you believe will have the greatest impact for the money that you're spending. So for, I'll give you an example. We have a great bill that comes up each year that says, we'd like to make sure that every school bus is a natural gas or a clean fuel, alternative fuel vehicle. The cost of that is enormous. It's not that it's a bad idea, it's a very good idea. But could you spend that same amount of money where DEQ, Department of Environmental Quality, is asking for more air monitors, they're asking for more. You gotta just compare these things and say, what will move the needle the most? And where that bill, where we're converting all the school buses, say in the state, and you were to say, how much would that collectively impact for the better? Versus how much would that same amount of money impact in other ways? You're trying to weigh that. And so there will be, and that's a long way of saying, I don't know how Senator Escamilla's bill stacks up to the return of others, but the baseline is pretty essential. I think you need to have it, so it sounds intuitive to me. Let me just say this. Miles mentioned on this trip, when we were in Shanghai, they were showing us their port. And when you're talking through a translator, you know how hard that is for me to like be succinct? I just have no way of doing it. And I got to, like, for a translator, I got to get down like two or three sentences and then let them repeat it, because it gets lost otherwise. So I'm struggling through this dinner. But the gentleman, once we had been there for a while, and I think he became a little more comfortable as he saw what we were talking about, he said, and he meant this not as a, this wasn't part of like the trade dispute, trade war. He wasn't trying to be mean about this. He was actually just being candid. He says, America does a lot of great things, but not ports. And he said that if you look today and you were to look at what these places look like and you see the trucks and you see how it's all moving, he wanted to show our delegation that was there the way they're doing it in Shanghai, where you have autonomous trucks, electric trucks that are moving and having the containers put on those trucks without anyone, not without an individual even there. You have this air traffic control tower that has the crane operators, which are people with joysticks, monitors, and there's a sight line to the crane. But this is a very efficient model. You don't see these plumes of diesel smoke billowing with trucks moving up and down. And what we saw in terms of the Shanghai port was what any of us on that trip would have called a best practice. So you ask yourself, well, why don't they do that in Long Beach or others? Because you could displace jobs if you did it that way. Where you're starting brand new, you can take the best practices and the smartest way to do this and the environmentally responsible way to do it, and we can begin it that way.
So then the environmental mitigation in terms of railroad air is largely going to be a matter of political will then, because the technology is there. I mean, finances
Absolutely.
Will matter. I'm not saying that. So then let's talk just for a second while we're in the environment.
Quick, one thing in terms of the environment and the political will, as I've been doing a bit of a listening tour across Utah, as I get up and running at World Trade Center Utah, as I try to understand the issues with the inland port, I've gotten with everybody I possibly can from the entire spectrum of whether or not they support the inland port or what the concerns are. And I have not found anybody who doesn't list air quality and the environmental issues as a priority. Mm-hmm. And that goes from people who are interested in, you know, shipping coal out of the Uinta Basin and right. Ephraim area to people who would you'd be more naturally inclined to care about the environment. Everybody recognizes that the geography that we have in Utah that makes life so great here, that helped us get the Olympics, that we all love going up and skiing on the weekends or at any time, also makes it more complicated for our air quality. And I spent a lot of time in Saudi Arabia. In Saudi Arabia, they have to pay more for their water because of their geography. I don't know anybody that doesn't recognize it along the Wasatch Front. We need to pay more for air because of our geography. And that's something that, as I've looked at it, has been universal. And so I have very, very strong confidence that there'll be political will. And it doesn't mean, I mean, there's still trade-offs, right? You still have to get the policy right. But there's a very, very strong unanimous support from what I've experienced to take environmental issues very, very seriously, and a recognition that if we're going to maximize the return or to maximize the value created from this opportunity, we have to get the environmental issues right, because that's what makes it sustainable and enhancing for our quality of life and not detrimental in the long term.
How much control does a port authority have over what is transited through?
I think any port authority would be foolish to create haves and have-nots.
Okay.
I think that the economy will drive that. I think you'll have incredible demand, and with that demand, there will be supply. People will meet that demand, and I think I don't think you want to get into the game where you have politicians deciding the winners and losers in that. I think that there's a smart play to be had. Let's talk about natural resources just real quick. I've heard a concept, and it actually makes all the sense in the world. If we look at global climate change, and we believe that the fossil fuels are having a damaging effect on the planet, you're not going to find any lawmaker that I know, at least, that says we want to boil this earth and we want it to be hotter and we want calamity. There's no one wants that. You do feel a little small sometimes in Utah where you don't know that you can boil the ocean, so to speak, or what you decide to do here will have the global impact in a global community. I think that's where we start to talk past each other on environment. So we know that there aren't coal-fired power plants being developed in the United States any longer. In fact, they're shutting down. But if you know that Japan, say, where nuclear has just not worked out for them with tsunamis and everything else, and they have 40 coal-fired power plants being planned and being planned to be developed, if it is the case that the Carbon County coal is cleaner than the coal that they would find in China or other places, and it would be the cleanest, wouldn't that be a way where you don't see an entire economy shut down in Utah, per se? There is a cleaner coal than they would find somewhere else, and be able to supply that if those coal-fired power plants were going to be up and running in some time. And that's where I'd love there to be a little bit more of that connection where we're talking about, you know, if you extract it, you're going to burn it. If you burn it, it may harm the planet. And I concur with that. But if you know that that's going to happen somewhere in this global community, and we think we have solutions here, I think we should give it a try. The worst thing we can do, and I'll pull it into the homeless issue. I went to all the community councils on Operation Rio Grande. And if you're coming to a library or somewhere to talk about Operation Rio Grande, there's a refiner's fire. You're a conscientious citizen. You're watching what's going on around you. You care. It's a special group you meet with. Town hall meetings, sure. It's not just with a bullhorn on I-15 yelling something. We would have an incredible conversation about what we were doing to address those that are experiencing homelessness, how to help people who are in need, people that are being preyed upon, and then inevitably in that conversation, the question would be asked, what about housing? What about transitional housing? How do people get from that circumstance to a place where they can be self-reliant and have a home? So we talk about transitional housing and what it means. But I would ask this question that would change the whole, we're all getting along, we're talking about solutions, we're problem solving, everybody's getting along, and I say, I'm up in the avenues, how about here? How about if we do some mixed use here? We'll do some transitional, we'll do some affordable, we'll do some market rate, and in that room, you could see almost a physical recoil about, well, I liked a housing until mm-hmm. you were talking about my very neighborhood.
And in Utah, we're certainly at the not in my backyard stage of
absolutely.
Growth, right?
So ballpark, sure. Whether I was in Glendale, you name it. I didn't have this conversation where when we said, how about right here, there wasn't it was like a lead balloon in the room. So, but my point in that is this, okay? The moment we start pitting the economy or people's ability to make a living, so help you provide for their family, sure. and say you can't work or you can't do what it is that you're doing because of environmental concerns. When you pit those two things against each other, that's where I think the problem is really. We have to find where there is common ground.
Sure.
There is way to do this together, but you got to be careful because you don't want that cynicism to seep in.
Right.
And it does.
Right.
That's Utah House Speaker Greg Hughes speaking at the Hinckley Institute of Politics panel on the Inland Port on February 4th, 2019. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma.
We're going to go to questions in 1 second after you have a comment. So then we're going to go to questions, and then I have one final question for you all as well. So you can hijack my final question if you have a platform you'd like to. And I'm putting you on a timer, speaker.
I was just going to point out that even Draper, his hometown, the mayor got raked over the coals over
yes.
that. So the interesting thing about this property, the Inland Port, is that it is private property, whereas a lot of ports are owned by either a county, a city, or a state. So in moving forward, you know, you can either help drive the type of development that these this individual owns the property with, or you can have these businesses that are polluting the environment more so than what we would like to see. So for me, it's having that type of relationship with the stakeholders out there to help them to be successful in creating manufacturing jobs for the area.
Perfect. So we're going to open it up for questions. I would remind you that we have our friends on the radio, so please make sure you have a mic if you speak.
So I sort of have two questions. When this was first being proposed, as I remember it in last summer when I first heard it, one of the questions environmentally was about what materials are going to be moving through the inland port. I remember there was maybe something in the TRIB about nuclear materials or nuclear waste moving through the port, and it kind of ties into another question that I have is being private property and privately owned, how is there going to be any oversight? Where is that oversight going to come from to make sure there isn't an accident? Because it only needs to happen once. Maybe there is, and it's just some information I don't already know, but I would like to know.
So from my perspective, I can tell you that when we talked about, there never when discussing the inland port, was there a ban on, say, natural resources. No coal, no yellow wax, black wax, none of that. There was no discussion. In fact, the question was asked a number of times, is there going to be those bans on those things? And the answer to that was no. It has a land use plan. It has, I would argue, a strict land use and what you can and can't do on that land and what it's imagined for. Because remember, we're going to use a tax increment to try and bring the infrastructure in. You can't contradict the mission of what an inland port would be, but you can't be cavalier. One of the things that was brought up in our special session is that there was this worry that there'd be mountains of coal. You just come in, you just dump it, and you just see it forever. And so we have worked through that to make sure that it's prescriptive to some degree. But I think that beyond what is written in the law and what we have said, because there is some standards there, I think this satellite model is going to take care of those things. I imagine an inland port in Salt Lake City that won't see natural resources because it just logistically doesn't make sense to see them coming through there. So there is structure to it, but I think we haven't been overly prescriptive of what can or can't be in there. But the oversight would be when it becomes that bonded U.S. Customs port. The land use, the city has a land use plan that they overlay on the area. That all has to be adhered to.
If you don't mind, will there be nuclear material being imported? So there's just a repeat of the question of where there'll be nuclear material.
Yeah, I don't know. No one's brought it to me that that's what would be moving through. In fact, the storage of most of the spent, are you talking about spent fuel rods, things like that? Because right now, I think the U.S. Department of Energy, they're storing them on site wherever it's created. I don't know that there's been the ghost chutes, that plan isn't there any longer. And having them stored in a safe spot, even Yucca Mountain in Nevada, that I don't think that's going anywhere. So I don't see nuclear as a role. No one's brought it up. No one's discussed it. And
so
I think right now,
the Inland Port Authority has not specified yet what would be transported. And I think there is probably, as the speaker said, a point of view that says you're not going to start out probably heavily regulatory, but that is to be developed in the business
plan. Yeah, I think these are great questions, and they're great questions when we go into the business plan, we start addressing those policy issues. So obviously I don't want nuclear waste out there in my backyard, right? So, and I'm sure everybody else on the board would feel the same way. I mean, I know people are extremely skeptical about the inland port, but all 11 board members seem to be on the same page when it comes to environmental issues, so specifically the air quality. So I don't know if that's going to answer your question, but as you pay attention, as the business plan rolls forth, these are the questions that need to be addressed to the Inland Port Authority. So yes, that will be on the top list as we move forward to make sure that is not.
That girl has.
So my questions to the councilman, how do you deal with a state legislator that has been so overreaching in Salt Lake City's like issues regards to the port, regards to the economics and environment? How do you deal with like a legislator that's not quite listening to what your constituents want?
That's a really good question. You know, if you look at the history of Salt Lake City, we're an extremely progressive city, right? You know, whether it's looking at doing bicycles and pedestrians going through drive-thrus, or it's the non-idling ordinance, you know, the two-minute ordinance. You know, we've got Big Brother, who's the state of Utah, who always watches over us, right? But I have to say that if you don't have a seat at the table, you become the dinner. And for Salt Lake City, it was imperative for us to have a seat at the table, meaning that I represent the council on the inland port. So you can see we were unanimous, which is hard. You know, you have seven elected officials, seven different points of view, and if you all come together, there's something to be said there. So we all were unanimous in making sure that we had a seat at the table. We do have a seat at the table, and, you know, I don't want to bag on our mayor, but she doesn't. I mean, you look at where she went, she was all in favor of an inland port, and now she's dragging her heels in it because she doesn't have a seat at the table.
Can I just give you examples so that Salt Lake City doesn't feel specifically picked on? I have a number of mayors. We passed a bill last year that said, look, for those jurisdictions that have homeless resource centers, and Salt Lake City has, what do you have, two of the four?
Yes.
And so you have the Midvale Family Center and you have South Salt Lake. We've said to those cities that do not have a resource center or facilities like that, part of your sales tax will go to those jurisdictions that have the resource centers. That was not well received. The same question was asked, why would I have to pay and see money go to Salt Lake City? And the answer is, well, then have a resource center and have a place where you help people that are in need. But as long as the people in need are going to specific places, two of them in Salt Lake City, we're all chipping in as cities. Those cities would tell you that some lawmaker, Hughes, decided to take their sales tax dollars and send them to Salt Lake City, and that wasn't fair. But there is that legislative job of looking at the state wholly and looking at some of these issues that impacts the whole state and how you create that policy to not only, you don't want to hurt the jurisdiction you're talking about, but you do make those decisions. And so, you know, I think cities, when they work with the legislature, we work very closely with them. But there are other cities, some will come away with the same kind of thought that, wow, these lawmakers, they went and took the sales tax out of our city and sent it to Salt Lake City, and that's not right. So it's a tough line we walk.
You know, and just to highlight just a little bit more, that if you look at how it all came about, I mean, it was pretty unfair how Salt Lake City in the legislative session brought it up at the last, was it the second to last day or the last day in what we're looking at. So you've got to be able to work with your legislators, elected officials. And that means from the administration to the city council to the elected senators and representatives in the area as well. So, I mean, it works both ways. It really does.
So, Councilman, I mean, I think what you would say as a member of both the city council and the Port Authority is hopefully that misstep, I think, by both the local jurisdiction and perhaps the state looking a little aggressive, hopefully is going to lead to more transparency as we do the Port Authority, because some of what we're feeling is some pushback about not knowing which way is up from the public. I think the net of that is the Port Authority is, the Port Authority would be anyway, but they have a keen eye to, it seems like, public conversations. So I think we have a couple more questions.
I think every presentation that I've seen or read on the port has made a great case for why Salt Lake is so ideally situated. I keep hearing how it's perfect. We have rail line. We know that because everybody wants it to be here. But what I'm not hearing a lot of is the benefit to us, the people who will live in the state and fund it, who are going to experience the effects of it. Every city that I've looked at that has one of these, they have two main issues that seem to pop up over and over, and one is the tax. What are you calling it? It's a clever name. The tax?
It's tax increment financing.
Is that basically tax abatement, right? Giving them so that losing the tax benefit has really hampered the cities that have one of these and has put them in a worse position at fixing the problems that may come down the road. We talk about, for example, air quality. Without that, those tax funds, we really are continuing to be in the same position we are in this state. The second problem is in the kinds of jobs. The only thing that this really brings to certainly the citizens of Salt Lake, but also to Utah, is the economic benefit. So what guarantees will we have that those jobs will be real jobs? Most of these jobs that are created are contract, temporary agencies, not the full-time secure jobs that allow people to stay in a community and build the community. They tend to be very transient. So what kinds of jobs can we be guaranteed of getting? What which those businesses will be required to offer, or will they be allowed to do the model that best serves their needs, which tends to be the contract temporary jobs?
As a representative of District 1, I think that this is a policy discussion as we discuss the tax increment financing. I think that this is where we can come up with some unique ideas, saying you can get X amount of tax increment financing if you hire so many employees within these zip codes, right? What types of jobs are they? Are they $13 an hour jobs, or are these career jobs? You know, are these the jobs that are manufacturing jobs, which are in huge demand right now in the state and across the nation? So, you know, these are questions for the tax increment policy discussion as we move forward for me. And I know that we have some a much broader vision here with Mr. Miles when it comes to the state of Utah and going out and getting these jobs. But, you know, there are these discussions to be had, and input from residents is key to making it happen.
I would hate to see this thing go forward without that piece being locked in place.
So example would be Stadler Rail. It's the largest rail car manufacturer in Europe, and they do the commuter rail, light rail cars. They've chosen Salt Lake City as their North American headquarters. The United States, if you want to bid for a rail car project in Dallas, anywhere in the country, Congress has a Buy America provision. So you have Siemens, which is headquartered in Sacramento, California. You have Bombardier that's also is domiciled in the United States. They do their manufacturing of those because they want to bid on the Atlanta, the Dallas, the Washington, D.C., the Sacramento line, the L.A. line, and they have to have a presence in the United States to be able to do that. Stadler Rail has won the bid in Dallas. I believe they've won one in California, the Los Angeles line. But they chose Salt Lake City, and when not only is your manufacturing, does it have to be here in the United States, but 80% of what you would use by way of materials needs to also come here. So you've seen 12 individual businesses that have come around Stadler Rail since they've announced and begun manufacturing rail cars here in Utah. And the reason why the port is important is that where they transport, how they transport, how they're able to move. A lot of automobile manufacturers are near Savannah, Georgia, which is a port city. You look at some of those that Boeing will look. It's looking at building a new airplane. It's going to look for places where they can bring in material, bring in supplies, have educated workforce, and then be able to move those things out. These ports are attract that kind of economy
so
and that kind
port,
of those kind
we
of jobs.
Have the time we need to find the right projects, right? I mean, one sentiment I think that underlies all this is that I think there's been a tradition in Utah because we haven't often been set. Looked at as a place to be. And sometimes intentionally in Utah, we didn't want to be, right? We wanted to be left alone. And I think there's a sentiment that sometimes we go for the first person who says hello to us instead of you know, dating a little bit, finding the right one. And so so do you feel like we have that disposition and time to make sure we're finding the right partners?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that what we've heard is a very rigorous process to get the policy right. We need to get the policy framework in place. We need a business plan to make sure that the type of projects that we take on in the inland port, to the point there, that they're the type of jobs that we want and we need along the Wasatch Front. I'm a big advocate that if the inland port becomes a goal in and of itself and it becomes a warehouse and distribution center, those aren't the type of jobs that are going to help enhance the quality of life along the Wasatch Front. It needs to be a tool that enables the rise and spread of advanced manufacturing in Utah, like Stadler Rail, exactly. I think that's a perfect example. Boeing would be another one where they're bringing really great jobs, long-term pension plans, everything else. Those are the type of jobs we want along the Wasatch Front. And it's also important to keep in mind that we are at the tail end of what will most certainly be the longest economic expansion ever. We don't have to worry about jobs right now, right? We're at full employment. But we know that in life, there's death, there's taxes, and there's the business cycle. There's going to be an economic downturn, whether that's 12 months or 24 months or 36 months from now, it's going to happen. And so we need to use the strength of the moment now to prepare for this, to the downturn that's going to come. And Utah's going to do okay in a downturn. We're going to continue to move forward. But the inland port gives us an opportunity to attract and be selective in the process of doing so. Manufacturers are going to create good jobs. They're going to help enhance quality of life here along the Wasatch Front.
So it looks like we're out of time for questions. What I think those of you on the radio can't see is that we have another dozen questions in the audience. So I think what this indicates to us is where we are in the discussion of the inland port, right? And it certainly indicates how many unknowns there are. I think we as citizens in interacting on this issue need to recognize where the Port Authority is and not having the answers. We want a Port Authority, I think, that doesn't say I've got all the answers right now, because that means there was no input to it. And I think that what we ask of the Port Authority is that, and actually other stakeholders like Mr. Hansen and Mr. Hughes, is that we clearly need more discussion to understand this. I'm going to ask then for an answer from all of you about, I want some inside baseball. I don't want this to be shellacked. I want some inside baseball about, if I'm trying to watch this, if I'm reading the newspapers, who should I be paying attention to? What word should, tax increment came up. What words should I be paying attention to? And what people, what players should I be watching? Whether they're, you don't have to tell me whether they're bad actors or good actors. I want to know who's making the inside baseball plays that I should be paying attention to.
Go first. So I'm not going to pretend to know the inside baseball. And I do apologize that I'm going to have to drop the mic after this one, because I've been summoned up to the Hill for a meeting at 1:30. So I apologize for checking out a little early. But I'll leave the inside baseball to the person who knows it better than I.
I'm gonna narc them all out.
But the one concluding thought I'd give is that this is an opportunity that we need to get right. So these types of conversations are perfect. We need to understand the issues and make sure we focus on maximizing the value this creates for the state of Utah. From the World Trade Center Utah perspective, I am a very strong advocate that as this project develops, we need to get international players, whether it's Shanghai ports, Dubai ports, other international movers and shakers, if you will, in the industry with skin in the game here in Utah. And I think there'll be opportunities to bring investment into Utah, to create partnerships, to make sure that the people and the institutions around the world that are really leading out in this industry, that they have a vested interest in helping make sure that we maximize the value that we create from this project, and we can create the type of jobs that we're going to want moving forward. So with that,
thank you all, and
I'm going to run out of here.
Thank you.
Leave it to the experts.
Well, I'm just, like I said, I'm a recovering lawmaker, so I don't have, I don't have any button to press or any influence going on up at that hill. But I will tell you this, if you want to keep your eye on what's going on, that Inland Port Board meeting is incredibly important. In hindsight, I ask myself all the time, that was a compromise bill. I know it felt rushed, but let me just say, in defense of transparency, you had your leadership in the House and Senate who came off the Hill during last year's general session and attended the working group of Salt Lake City with their council and the mayor. I don't think you've seen that before. Someone would have to tell me when that's occurred. I don't think it has. You had myself, Representative Gibson, Senator Stevenson, who spent a number of hours on a Saturday at the state fairgrounds talking to the constituents and the people from that area, looking for that feedback. And that wasn't late in the session. That was early in the session. This was understood for a long time. The House, it's a 45-day session, if you include the weekends. That's not all work days. We received from the Senate the bill, on the evening of day 43. So that is, if there was a sense of rush, the House felt that as well, because we didn't even receive the bill till the evening of the 43rd day, which was not ideal and not what we thought would happen. But again, I don't think we would have seen as much progress as we have made, and some of these solutions that have come to the top because we have a board, because we're having public hearings, because we're moving forward, there's an urgency to what we're doing. Everything in politics is momentum. There's so much that attacks your public servants' time and attention. There's an urgency to this to get it right. I think that's made this a better process. Watch the Inland Port Board meetings. Watch for other jurisdictions that want to be a part of the global supply chain and have and are going to proffer to this board solutions where they can be part of this. I think that will change the psychology of this at least, because right now it feels like this is being foisted on a political subdivision. I think you're going to see a lot of counties and a lot of areas that with the opportunity to be part of that global supply chain done responsibly, you're going to see willing participants. And I think that's something that I'm hoping people pay attention to. The other part of that is, no matter what discussion happens in the Inland Port Board and those jurisdictions that would like to be part of it, there's going to need to be a participation from the state by way of infrastructure, rail. If you look at what the impact on carbon emissions for trucks versus if you rail things in and out, it is cleaner to have rail. Rail is incredibly expensive, but if we do this right, there's going to need to be that commitment from the state. You got to watch for it. Watch to make sure that participation from the state on the infrastructure, on this hub and spoke model, because I think it has to be a hub and spoke model, is actually moving forward. And so those are the things you'd look at. And if you see it, tell people about it, because I think it actually is addressing some of the concerns that I think are legitimate that people are hearing.
Key stakeholders, right?
Right.
I'd say the landowners. I'd say that you need to watch the leadership of the Inland Port, which is myself and Derek Miller, who's the current president, the current chair. And so those are, you know, we need to bring the private property owners in as well to understand where the board is at. And I know they understand it because they follow it, but so that we have the same vision in the business plan and everybody's input on the business plan is moving it forward, because that business plan is that 15,000 foot view where we're going to be driving this Inland Port. And do we want to create drop ship businesses? I don't. I want to create manufacturing jobs. I want to create manufacturing jobs for the community, for the state of Utah.
Terrific. Thank you to our panel for your insights and your expertise, and thank you to the Hinckley Institute.
This program was made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, producer and host of this program. Thanks for listening.